This show was first broadcast on Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. For more information on Fresh FM, as well as links to other great locally produced programs, go to our website, freshfm.net.
Hello and welcome. I'm Galen Pound, and you're listening to Top Writers. In a few moments, I'll be talking to multi-award-winning Nelson-based young adult author Rachel Krawe about her Spark trilogy and the upcoming release in November of her much-anticipated new book, The Rift. But first, we're going to hear from Dana.
This is Dana Wensley, and you're listening to Top Writers. I want to take a few minutes to talk to you about freedom of speech. I'm the Freedom of Speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand. PEN is an international human rights organisation that promotes literature and freedom of expression. Today I want to talk to you about communicating science and the issue of fake news. With elections closing in on us and climate change a hot topic of debate, it's time to consider the issue of fake news and the role it can play in destabilising the democratic process. Professor Sir Peter Gluckman, Chief Science Advisor to the Prime Minister, has just released his report, Enhancing Evidence-Information Policymaking. His accompanying letter to the Prime Minister draws attention to the worrisome rise of post-truth polemic and the greater and easier promulgation of fake news. He says, "The worrisome rise of post-truth polemic and the greater and easier promulgation of false news that we have seen globally in recent times can be seen as threats to the democratic process, social cohesion, and good governance. I believe that a commitment to protect and enhance the evidential input into the policy process is an increasingly important defence against these trends." Scientists have coined a word for studying the post-truth world, agnotology, or the study of ignorance. Agnotology is the study of what we don't know. More specifically, the study of how ignorance is used by those with vested interest to discredit established scientific findings for their own personal or political gain. A recent example of which is President Donald Trump's assertion labelling global warming as a hoax created by and for the Chinese. On Sunday, I interviewed science journalist and broadcaster Veronica Maduna at the Mapua Literary Festival. Known to us as the host of Radio New Zealand's A Changing World, Maduna's book, Warmer World, What Climate Change Will Mean for New Zealand's Future, is a valuable contribution to this discussion of climate change. This is what she had to say.
Climate change is a slow-burning emergency, a very long-term issue. It's complicated, it's threatening, and it asks us to change behaviour. And none of this is making it any easier to tell a story, because we're all naturally resistant to changing in significant ways for something that seems to be lying out in the future for, you know, some time. So I can see that it's not easy to even start thinking about what you can change in your own, you know, individual personal life. I can sort of understand where it's coming from. Where I don't have any patience for is the deliberate denial that, knowing what's going on, but because you happen to have vested interests, thinking of strategies of how you can delay any action or get any form of obfuscation. We've known it from the, say, tobacco industry, and it's exactly the same pattern. So that I have no patience for.
Veronica Maduna is New Zealand's first editor of The Conversation, a knowledge-based online journalism site that links university scholars and researchers to a wider audience. So it was natural that my discussion covered issues relating to science writing and communication in the post-truth world. Here she is talking about her role as editor of The Conversation.
I've recently taken on a role as the New Zealand editor for The Conversation. And The Conversation is a relatively new media organisation, it's only 6 years old. But what they do, you know, how they operate, is they work with researchers as writers. So my role as a journalist is as an editor, really. I no longer write the pieces. I wrangle the authors and I help them with the writing if they need any help. But they are the writers, and for me that's like bringing them to first voice There's nobody interviewing them, nobody rephrasing what they're saying, nobody pulling out the bits and pieces that are then used as quotes, nobody interpreting what they say. They are the first voice. And I think for readers or consumers of the media in the broadest sense, to hear the first voice of people in research, to hear from, I don't like the word experts, but that's what they are. They're people who spend their life researching a particular aspect, and that's what they can talk about with expertise and with a depth of knowledge that other people don't have. And for us to hear from them in the first voice, and clearly is one way I think we can bring, in the broadest sense, society and the public closer to the evidence base.
That was science journalist and broadcaster Veronica Maduna talking to me at the Mapua Literary Festival. These are some of the discussions Penn is having both here and in New Zealand. If you want to find out more about Penn and what it does, contact me, Dana Wensley, at penn@nzauthors.org.nz or follow the links on the New Zealand Society of Authors website to Penn at www.authors.org.nz.
I'm Galen Pound and you're listening to Top Writers. My guest today is young adult writer Rachel Craw. Welcome to Top Writers, Rachel.
Hi, Galen. Thank you for having me.
Could you please tell us what your hugely popular Spark trilogy is about?
Yeah, so the Spark trilogy is a story about a girl who discovers that she's been genetically engineered to save her best friend's life. And it's a discovery that comes unexpectedly, and she notices strange shifts and changes in her body, sudden bursts of adrenaline that give her unexpected strength. And then things keep happening and she starts to become aware of these changes. And then as things are revealed to her by people who have more information, she discovers that she's a part of a genetic experiment that started in the early 70s from a fairly mercenary corporation called the Affinity Project, and who were originally looking to create super soldiers for hire, essentially to make money. The experiment went wrong, and some of the people who came in contact with the genetic engineering turned out to be psychopathic killers, and some of them turned out to have protective tendencies. And Evie, who's the central character, is one of those with the protective tendencies. She's a shield, and so it's her job to save her best friend's life, and she's being targeted by one of the genetically engineered killers. And so really the first story in the series is really about whether or not she can save her best friend's life. And as the series progresses in book two and Stray, Evie actually goes into the organization, the Affinity Project, and she learns more about the workings of the organization. And in the third book, Shield, it's really about whether or not Evie can, I guess, stand up to the organization and not be their puppet. And things come to a head in a fairly dramatic way.
Right. Female heroines are becoming very prevalent in younger adult novels, like the most obvious being Katniss from The Hunger Games. Why did you decide on having Evie as the female heroine as opposed to a male?
I don't think that was a conscious, like, I will write that for any kind of political reason. It was purely that when I decided to start writing, I knew that I wanted to write young adult fiction, and I knew that I wanted to write a girl and that she would be 17 years old. I knew that there would be a fantastical element to the story. And at that time, which was, you know, nearly 10 years ago when I first started working on it, the market was fairly saturated with supernatural storylines, and I felt like I didn't want to write a supernatural story. And then I thought, well, if she's going to have abilities, where do they come from? And those abilities ultimately had to come from science. And then that really took me down that path of the science fiction element for it.
And where did the idea for the books come from?
It came from a dream. So I just had my third child. So I could have been quite sleep deprived and crazy on baby hormones. I don't know. And I was really dying to write. Like, I was just itching to write a story. And so I knew those things in advance. I knew I knew that it would be YA. I knew that I would write a girl. I knew that there would be some kind of fantastical element, but I didn't have the premise. And one night, in a state of desperation, I sat on my bed and I prayed for an idea. And then I went to sleep and I had the dream, which became the prologue of Spark. And in that dream, I was running through a forest at night and I had these incredible stamina and strength and reflexes. And I knew in the dream that there was somebody out in the forest who was in danger and that it was my responsibility to reach that person. And that if I didn't reach them first, that someone else would, and that the other person was dangerous and would kill them. And if I wasn't there, and if I wasn't able to save that person, it would be my responsibility. And so the urgency in the dream was so intense, and all the fear that I had was for the person and not for myself. And then I just woke up, and I knew that that was my answer to my prayer. That was my idea. And I got up because my baby woke me up in the night, as they do. And I went in and I was feeding my baby and I was sitting there thinking, I think this is the answer. This is my idea. And I just sat there in the dark, just asking lots of questions like, where did all that strength and stamina come from? Where did all those reflexes come from? And I knew that the feeling in it was, it felt like, you know, radioactive spider bite. You know, like it felt like something that had been cooked up in a lab. And then I also, you know, asked questions like, how did I know that there was someone out there? Why was it so urgent? Why was it my responsibility? And that's where the idea for the evil organization and the DNA aspect started coming into the story. And so by the time I put my baby back in her crib, I was like, okay, we're going with evil organization. <You know? laughs> So it was exciting, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing how much great literature does come from dreams. I mean, Kubla Khan is the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah.
But, you know, Chekhov used to wake up in the middle of the night and write ideas on the wallpaper in his room. And
so I definitely feel that one of my most creative times, obviously as being unconscious, is the act of falling asleep or waking up. So many plot solutions come to me in that in between space from being asleep to coming awake, and then I'll be like, oh, answers will just slip into place. Yeah. And I've got a few other stories that have come to me in dreams as well that I have notes for, but I haven't turned those into novels yet.
Now, the Spark trilogy is set in America as opposed to New Zealand. Was that conscious or...?
I really wish that I could say something meaningful about that. No, I didn't even think about it. Like, it didn't even, I was not like, yes, I will set this book in America. No, I didn't even think about it. And I guess probably the logistics of it, I did not give any time to really thinking through. Like, I thought, I feel like it's an evil organization. I feel like, you know, the whole idea of creating super soldiers for hire, in my mind, could not feasibly imagine that happening in New Zealand. Like, because I was thinking logistically, how would that work? Like, if you were an evil organization, if you were like looking to hire an evil, you know, a super assassin, it's not very convenient if you live in Russia. If you want to, you know, could you send an assassin? He'll be there in a very convenient 3 days. I don't think that would work. So I just felt like it feels like an American story. It feels like big evil corporate. You know?
And so, it was written before Trump was elected president.
That's right. Yeah, so I don't know. But I didn't actually give it much time either to really think about that. Right. If I had given it time and thought perhaps I could find a reason to set it in New Zealand, but it didn't feel important.
Right, now, your first novel, Spark, has been optioned for a film by Misconception Films.
Yes.
Tell us a little about that.
Yeah. Walker Books Australia took Spark to a pitch meeting. I don't know what you call them. It's like when there's a bunch of filmmakers, they come to like a conference and there are heaps of publishers there who are pitching ideas, and then creatives are looking at, oh, could we use that? Could we use that? And there was just a really good synergy between Misconception Films and Spark, because Ainsley Gardner, who is the head of Misconception Films, their real MO is like trying to create stories or trying to create films which have really strong female protagonists and wanting to kind of make films that have great role models for young women. And they felt that Evie was one of those types for them. So yeah, that's really where it started. And so Ainsley has been working hard to try and polish up a script. She has reoptioned the rights for another year. And so she's working to try and bring that script up to pitching level four, you know, getting financial backing for it. So who knows? Who knows what will happen? It'd be awesome if something did happen, but, you know, these things are mystical and unknown. How do these things happen? I don't even know, right?
Well, maybe we'll catch up with you when it does actually become a reality.
That would be very cool.
Right. Now, your new book, The Riff, is due for release in November.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yes. So The Rift came about in an odd sort of way. I kind of have this bucket list of things that I want to write. Like, for instance, I would love to write... Well, The Rift came out of the desire to write a shapeshifter story. Though technically, that's not actually what it turned out to be. Right. But that was the thrust of me heading in that direction. And there are other things that I would love to write, like I'd really love to write like a body snatcher story. You know, those old 1980s, yes, like aliens come and they take over your body and then you're the last kid in the neighborhood who knows that actually that's not your parents, that's an alien in your parents' body, you know. So there's that kind of, I'd love to write that kind of story. And some of the things that really influenced me in childhood was like the Twilight Zone. And like those kinds of really creepy stories, like you go to a town and then you can't escape, those kinds of things. Like there are things that in my backlist of one day I will write this story. So for The Rift, it was, I want to write a shapeshifter story. And so what I had in my mind, or the image that kept coming into my mind, was the idea of a man who turned into a stag. And I thought, you know, for sure there's going to be pre-existing mythology, right? And so, of course, I just spent a little bit of time with Google trying to access some of those stories and see what was around. And there are a bunch, like from different cultures and things. And I really wasn't particularly interested in trying to rewrite someone's, like there's a few Celtic myths and things. And I didn't want to write an adaptation. And then I came across the story of Actaeon from Greek mythology, who was an unfortunate hunter who stumbled across the goddess Artemis bathing naked in the woods. She was not best pleased, and so she cursed him, and he turned into a stag who was torn apart by his own hunting dogs. And I just loved that story. Like, I just loved that whole idea. And I just started asking that question, well, what if Actaeon didn't die? What if that curse, and the whole, I really love the idea of a curse, like something that's set in motion that has just constant ongoing consequences that just roll on and on and on. And I was imagining, what if that curse just rolled on through the generations and through the generations, and what would that look like? And so part of my creative process in accessing that story was to actually attempt to write Actaeon's own story. Like, so I wrote a short story from Actaeon's point of view, and getting into his body and trying to imagine what it would feel like to transform into a stag, and then have your dogs that you have raised by hand that you love actually chase you down. And, you know, what was that like? And yeah, so I wrote his story for my, like a short story, creative kind of exercise to get into the story. And then I was like, you know, what if he had a wife, and what if she was pregnant, and what if that curse, you know, was something that impacted her? And the cool thing is that Artemis is, you know, she's the goddess of childbirth and mothers, even though she's the virgin. And I was sort of thinking of how horrified Artemis would be to discover that the curse that she had placed on this man impacted this poor innocent woman. And so I just took the myth on into a what if. What if the goddess regretted her actions?
So Rift, this novel, it came out of all of that, and it's actually about?
The story is centered around an ancient ranger community who live on this island where there is a herd of deer whose antlers contain a potent healing compound that's called Actaeon's Bane. The potent healing compound is highly prized, and a big pharmaceuticals company always wants to get their hands on it. The rangers protect the island from poachers, protect the island from the people who are coming after these deer. And the central character is a boy who's an apprentice ranger and a girl who is the estranged daughter of the head ranger of the community. And they come together before a big cull, which will happen to, in order to protect the ecosystem of the island. And big things go down, and there is a dimensional rift on the island through which the hounds come and plague the deer, and the rangers try to protect the deer and the community from the hounds as well. So, yeah.
And now we're going to be very privileged, because the book's not due out until November, to hear a little bit of the book.
This is the first chapter, called Warning Notes. Cal's too late. He knows it even as he leaps down the thickly treed slope, knees jarring with the impact of each footfall. Certainty like an iron clamp fastens at the top of his throat, making his breath short. The long oilskin hampers his stride, his rifle thumps, bruising his hip. Heavy rain slicks his hair to his face and he mops it back, hot with frustration and fear. Everything's working against him. Weather, terrain, gear, the thunder of his pulse obscuring the voice of the herd. Clinging to the initial flare of instinct, Cal makes for the western spit. He strains to hear past the torrential rain. There's no howling. Of course there's no howling. Not this early in the lunar cycle. Reaver's frantic cawing echoes above the treetops, and he curses her, useless bird. He could have used the aerial support to boost his night vision. His boots slide in the wet mud and leaf mold, threatening to wrench his ankles. It must be a full 5 minutes since he first felt the alarm up on the ridgeway. Perhaps he should be grateful he's too agitated to tap into it now. The signal must be roaring with grief. That first sign of distress had been a shock vibration in his mind, like the string of a fragile instrument viciously plucked. If he'd been concentrating, he'd have caught the early warning notes of danger and deployed his raven to scout. But he hadn't been paying attention, too self-absorbed, obsessing over the news he'd heard in the mess hall this morning. Meg Archer is coming home. Meg Archer. When the signal from the old herd finally broke into his consciousness, panic cost him precious seconds and his link with Reaver. Cal curses himself. This proves everything they've ever said about you. You worthless piece of... An image flashes into his mind. A doe, tall, slender, strong, a sable coat with silver markings on her chest and flanks. Deep brown, fathomless eyes, ancient, knowing, wild. His gut plummets. What if it's Fallon? What if it's Fallon and she's been killed by a trapper's sneer? The unthinkable shame of losing the matriarch of the old herd, it scrambles his brain. He pictures himself denounced by the head ranger before the whole community, cast out under the full weight of his failure, heralding the total collapse of everything the Blackwater Rangers stand for. Thousands of years of toil, trials, and tradition passed from parent to child, nullified in a single night's screw-up by a kid who never deserved to be counted amongst their ranks. God, God, please don't let it be Fallon. As if her name in his thoughts summons them, the voice of the herd flickers in his mind. He gasps or sobs and skids to a stop. Chest heaving, quads and calves burning, the momentary relief of connection fills him, centers him. Oneness, wonder and a longing for the mountain, longing for the veins of living energy pulsing in the ley lines. He listens, even that small flicker thrums with oppressive grief. Knowing fills him, confirming the location like an internal GPS. There in the deep shadow, 40 feet below where the narrow track twists back on itself, a light grey smudge swings from a noose. His skin contracts with goose flesh. If his hair wasn't slick to his head, tendrils would rise at the nape of his neck. He sees the antlers and his heart beats. It's not Fallon, it's not Fallon.
Thank you, Rachel. And that's from your book, The Rift, which is due out in November. Now, the song you've chosen today is...
Bull and Biscuit by Jack White.
Right, let's listen to Jack White.
Rachel. Rachel's books are available from all good bookshops. I'm Galen Pound and you've been listening to Top Writers. This is the last program in the session, but we will be back with you in the near future. A podcast of this program and upcoming events can be found on www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this podcast available by funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Other great programs from Fresh FM are available through iTunes, the Stitcher app, the TuneIn Radio app, and our website, freshfm.net.